There have been criticisms from a bunch of different directions about this bill. So let me just address a few of them. Some of the criticisms really are with the basic idea that government should intervene at all in this moment of crisis. I mean, you have some people, very sincere, who philosophically just think that government has no business interfering in the marketplace. And in fact, there are several who suggested that FDR was wrong to intervene back in the New Deal. They're fighting battles that I thought were resolved a pretty long time ago.
American History F'd, Part 5. Let's make a hero, Franklin Roosevelt. Critical thinking question. And the cynicism in this question is only applicable to that dark tunnel of political participation. You know that light at the end of the tunnel that political leaders are always pointing at, telling us to be hopeful about, directing us to follow them in that direction? What if that distant illumination is actually just the headlight on a big, dirty, oncoming train with no brakes? Oh, I'm sorry, another big, dirty, oncoming train with no brakes.
Have you been reading anything about the Depression, anything about FDR?
You know, I have, actually. There's a new book out about FDR's first 100 days.
Hi, I'm Michael Moynihan for Reason TV. The American economy is in crisis, and Barack Obama has promised to change Washington. But some of those closest to Obama and some of his loudest media cheerleaders are advising him to look backwards towards FDR's New Deal for inspiration.
The idea of a new deal has crossed the lips of countless Democrats in the past 6 months. As Massachusetts Congressman Jim McGovern recently said, "I think we could be on the edge of an era in this country of bold, dramatic change equal to the Great Society and the New Deal." An aide close to Obama told New York Magazine that a lot of people around Barack are reading books about FDR's first 100 days. A kind of New Deal mania has gripped the pundit class.
Your book is the defining moment, FDR's 100 days and the triumph of hope.
It's the New Deal, and it's Barack Obama as FDR.
No, I want him to call for something like a New Deal.
But what if everything we think we know about the New Deal is wrong? What if FDR's massive intervention to the American economy actually prolonged the Great Depression?
For something to restore our confidence, our hope, our courage. Without jobs, we had no money.
As popular myth has it, it was Keynesian economics that saved America from the Depression, delivering a wounded country from total disaster.
People to the breadlines. Anxiously we waited for some sign of better days. Then came the federal government's work program. One by one, it took us out of the...
Without the New Deal, say its defenders, America would have spiraled even deeper into economic crisis.
Into faces filled with hope and happiness, for now, we work again.
People who lived through the Depression said, Roosevelt saved us. And it's just a very closely held to the heart view.
That's UCLA economics professor Leo Hanyan, author, along with his colleague Harold Cole, of a study demonstrating that FDR's New Deal policies actually prolonged the Depression by 7 years.
The National Industrial Recovery Act, which was passed in 1933, allowed firms to collude. So, for example, if you and I were in the auto industry, you know, General Motors and Ford, the government allowed us to say, okay, we'll have a minimum price. You know, you don't undercut me, I won't undercut you. That leads to higher profits. And we could do that provided that we raised wages for our workers substantially. And that's exactly what happened. When you increase monopoly, and you increase the wage above the normal wage, you're going to have less output and less employment.
We didn't really have any recovery. I mean, unemployment remained 15-18% throughout the 1930s. So there is this flawed view. I think people are beginning to pick up on that.
So if the bold, persistent experimentation of the New Deal wasn't the economic panacea of popular myth, just what should FDR have done in 1933? According to Ohanian and Cole, if FDR had loosened the money supply, avoided the rigid fixing of wages and prices, and instead let market forces work, the economy would have restarted itself much sooner.
In other words, had the government not intervened in such a massive way, say Ohanian and Cole, the recovery would have been very rapid, and the economic slump would have ended as early as 1936. Instead, the Depression, by most estimates, lasted until 1943. The economy is officially in recession, and it looks like we're in for a long, slow road to recovery. But our situation is hardly analogous to the Great Depression. So is a new deal really what we need right now? Especially if it works like the old New Deal did? For Reason TV, I'm Michael Moynihan.
You're talking about spreading the wealth around. That's what he did.
Well, first of all,
that's what he did. Did he do that?
Absolutely.
And Obama says that's his man?
Okay.
Redistribution of wealth, sir.
He stepped in it, buddy.
Look, he stepped in it.
Look, anytime you build a road.
Quincy Jones climbed in the cabin. Quincy Jones. Orders in his hand. Quincy Jones leaning out the window. Taking a trip to the promised land. Headaches and heartaches and all kind of pain are all a part of the river.
When you look at, when any president, I feel any person who has the claws to climb into that kind of position of power, knowing what it is and knowing how they can use it, obviously they see any bounds or any limitations that are placed on their power merely as an inconvenience. And it's interesting, too, that the people who seem to have the least respect for the limitations of power that were placed upon them become the heroes in government school. And I think that it's interesting when people don't offer up Abraham Lincoln as the best president of the United States, their choice is almost invariably Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So who by many historians, many progressive historians, and many people working in higher education, they consider FDR to be the greatest president. So we really got into Lincoln, and I was hoping we could deal with FDR a little bit too, because, you know, I really think that those are the two people that are elevated the most above the other people who've held the office as president. And when you look at the reality of what they did, it's like there should be a special place in the hell of history for these kinds of people. So, I mean, if we look at Roosevelt's folklore, again, we have saved America from the Great Depression. Again, something that could be its own show.
Yeah.
But then sort of rallying the country and, giving people hope. Like, whenever I ask in my conversations with statists, what did FDR do that was so good? Well, he gave people hope. Well, Stalin and Mussolini and Hitler gave people hope in those places. If we start to explore Roosevelt, what are the things that really stick out about him?
Well, my friend, I think I would have to start just sentimentally, going back to an anecdote. Briefly, my high school, Milford Area Senior High School, I had a teacher named Mrs. Cross. And it was first period modern American history. And she was probably one of the crappiest teachers I've ever had. And I just truly phenomenally bad. For example, if you were unfamiliar with a particular word, like let's say Luftwaffe or something like that, rather than writing the word Luftwaffe down on the board, she would say, and the Luftwaffe was an Air Force. And she would write down Air Force. Like, she didn't get a clue as to what to actually instruct people, that she couldn't put herself in your head and say, oh, well, maybe they might want to learn how to spell Luftwaffe, you know? It was terrible. So she used to just worship at the altar of FDR. And, of course, when I wrote that the articles that are inside Live Free or Die, I wrote about how at the time I wrote this one article on FDR. I was writing it when they were going to put the statue of FDR in Washington, D.C. And I thought, well, gee, isn't that great? They'll actually have a physical totem that they can kneel before all these statists, when before they could only have a sentimental ideological totem. Now they'll have a real statue of the guy. They can go and get their knees all bruised up as they go and bow before him and say he was wonderful. I used to sit there because my father was very much into reading about these things. I would argue with my teacher, and she'd come up with his alphabet soups of the Works Progress Administration and the AAA and all these types of things. And she would say, oh, you know, he saved America with these. And so I would bring up economic arguments, and I would start to say things. She literally would grab my head by the hair, make me be quiet. And I'd raise my hand and I would say, well, actually, you know, if you look at this, the money would be coming from this, and it's being showered for political things that are. And she'd just make me shut up. She'd be like, grab my hair. I just couldn't believe. And she did it in a joking way, but it was painful. And I sit there and say, what are you doing? You know, to not engage someone who's bringing up substantive things at, you know, 16 or 17 years old. Really is the mark of a true coward who doesn't know what she's talking about.
Yeah.
And so many people today don't know anything or virtually anything about FDR. They've been sold a bill of goods about this guy. They think that, you know, you hear all these things about how he brought us out of the depression and things like that. Well, you know, first, as we mentioned, let's just talk a little bit about this man's personality. This man was willing to slow down Patton from getting, and we could talk about how he suckered. I think how he suckered the Japanese, and I think there's a lot of evidence about this. There, let's start there. Let's start with World War II. We can talk about the Depression and how he picked up policies from Herbert Hoover. Let's talk about World War II for a minute, just on the personality side of this. FDR, they now have communiques that have been brought out through Freedom of Information Act requests, communicating with Winston Churchill, saying that he will do anything in his power to get the United States involved in the war. Now, people can say that that was important because the Nazis would have run right over Europe and they would have come after the United States. First they make the argument that people had to be saved in World War II, whether or not there was a threat to the United States. They'll make that argument. People had to be saved. Well, you know, a lot of people have to be saved a lot of places. And as evil as Hitler was, Stalin was wiping out just as many people, and nobody would hear about it until, you know, the conservatives and libertarians at the time would write about it. There are reasons that the Constitution is written, and the Constitution states very plainly that the United States military is to be used for certain things, and it's not to be used to save the lives of foreign people. I'm sorry, but that's not what it is. If you want to sign a check and give it out to hire a private military, you're free to do so. But the Constitution is not there so that some people can be forced to go into paying for a military operation in another country, no matter how laudable it is. You have to change the rules of the Constitution. So Roosevelt didn't want that. He wanted to make sure that a war was declared, and so he knew that he had to make the United States be threatened. So he imposed this embargo on Japan in the battle between Japan and China. Now, what does that have to do with the United States? Nothing. Nothing at all. But, of course, we know he said to Churchill he would do anything to get his country into the war. So he started doing things to get the United States in a position where the Japanese would attack. Then there's the code, the Japanese code. It had been broken by the Americans prior to Pearl Harbor, and they had intercepted communiques. And for a long time, if you watch the movie Tora, 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 which was made decades ago, they knew about it then. There were all these rumors about it, and it has been pretty much substantiated by people like Thomas Fleming and people like Jim Powell.
If I could just jump in there for a second, it reminds me of an interesting story that I heard. And, you know, one of the places, where I learned quite a bit about World War II was actually from a World War II veteran. I used to, you know, teach history in a private school, and during the summer I would paint houses. So, you know, I was painting this gentleman's house in Ipswich, Massachusetts, maybe four or five years ago. And, you know, I told him I was a history teacher, and he was a World War II veteran, so he wanted to, you know, come stand outside with his iced tea and talk to me while I painted. And it was, you know, it was really nice. It was really cool. But this World War II veteran, who was over 80 years old, was the first person to introduce me to the idea of a 9/11 conspiracy theory, which, you know, and as far as that goes, it's not going to change the way I feel. You know, and if they gave a press conference tomorrow and said, yeah, we did it, there'd be even more people who would convince themselves somehow that it wasn't true anyway. So that changes nothing. I think what's important to point out is that in the last 10 years, the U.S. government has killed over 100,000 people in Iraq, and people are people regardless of where they live. That should be enough of a tragedy for people to focus on. 9/11 does not matter. And I'm really, you know, I just haven't gotten that into that. It's not very compelling to me, that whole story. But it was very compelling to this man who had no access to the internet, who certainly hadn't seen, you know, an Alex Jones movie or been listening to Coast radio or something like that. His rationale for this belief that the George Bush administration had used 9/11 as a pretext, a false flag operation to get the United States into this further quest for Middle Eastern hegemony was his reference. Now, obviously, one doesn't prove the other, but he claimed to me that he was aware of the Japanese attack at Pearl Harbor a week before it happened.
Yeah, that's consistent with the type of thing that I had heard. And it seems, and we know, for example, that the bulk of the fleet that patrolled the area where the Japanese were moving and through which they were going to move was moved away. Roosevelt and his team moved the bulk of the U.S. fleet away from the cone where the Japanese would be moving into to pinpoint Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. They were gone. He pulled them out of there. Now, there are also, and people can say, well, you know, it's just circumstantial. There are also stories that come contemporaneous accounts of, and you can find this, I think, in Jim Powell's book. There is a contemporaneous account of a man who worked in the White House who overheard Roosevelt after Pearl Harbor, just shortly thereafter, say, I knew people were going to die, but I didn't know this many were going to die. This is in this man's diaries. We know that they had broken the code. We know that they had intercepted communiques. And one of the key players in relaying the information was given the day off and was out playing golf and was strangely unaware of what was going on. Now, people can say that it was all a screw up or whatever, but I would apply much more sinister intentions to this, especially given some of the things that Roosevelt had said, which he did not make public. He ran as a peace candidate. Roosevelt, it's amazing. Roosevelt had said no more foreign wars, no more foreign interventions. And then once he got elected, shortly thereafter, he completely changed his tune. I mean, you know, it sounds a lot like George Bush, sounds a lot like Barack Obama. You know, all these guys. So anybody who is a person who wants to hold this guy up, please look more critically just at the man's honesty. And why was he unwilling to tell people that he was in communication with Winston Churchill and the United States had to do something to get into the war, that he somehow might have been afraid? Now, if he could have made an argument that the Nazi and Japanese and Italian axis was a threat to the United States, let him do so. But he knew he couldn't make the argument, so he pushed the United States into a position. And I was originally skeptical of this, but if you do a lot of reading on it, it's very, very clear to me. He pushed the United States through his operations of the military and through these tariffs and so on, to get the Japanese in a position where they would attack us. And it's truly tragic stuff. Now people can say that it was for a greater good. You know, that if this didn't happen, then the Nazis would have taken over Europe and gone for the United States eventually. Well, that remains to be seen. But one thing's for sure, based on what Roosevelt did, at the time, I just think this man was an evil, evil person. And besides that, like we said, he was very much in favor of breaking his oath to uphold the Constitution. He wanted to do things not to help people. For example, let's move into the economic side of it now, Brett, to talk about, you know, whether or not people should think that that Roosevelt was such a great guy.
Sure.
The economic side of it, yeah, that ties into his oath to the Constitution. Now, he swears an oath to uphold the Constitution. He knows that the Constitution does not allow all these special programs that he wants to put forward as he becomes president after the Great Crash and so on and so forth. So what does he do? He tries to institute all these programs, right? Now, if these programs were done on his basis were done to help Americans, then why did he delay the money from going out in many of these programs until after he got support from certain politicians in certain states? This is all documented in Amity Schley's book, The Forgotten Man. I mean, she has the dates at which certain people had come out with their support and the dates when he gave the money. The money for certain projects like building of airports and special field work and building of dams and all sorts of stuff. It was all done for political purposes. So if he was there to try to help these poor people in their fedora hats who didn't have work and he wanted to get them out there digging ditches and then have other people fill the ditches up later, real productive work. If he was so intent on paying people to pull balloons down city streets to get starlings off the sides of the buildings, which was one of the programs they spent money on. If he thought that that was going to be so helpful, then why did he delay the money until after he got support from the local politicians for his next campaigns?
You know, I think just on a side note there, the WPA did produce a couple of very informative and thought-provoking documentaries on the history of paperclips. so it's not all, you know, I think that's from Schley's too. I think that's where I learned that. But you're right. It's just these wasteful boondoggle projects that exist for the purpose of moving this money around in exchange for political favors.
That's right. Yes.
And, you know, it's interesting when we look at, you know, the economic side of Roosevelt's presidency and we look at the foreign policy and the military side of Roosevelt's presidency. The interesting thing is that when we compare Roosevelt to Lincoln from a historiography perspective, it seems like Lincoln's history was written later and embellished later, but it almost seems like Roosevelt had more of a PR machine working for him.
Very smart. Yes.
When I look at the time period, it's kind of like are Goebbels and Hitler learning from Roosevelt, or is Roosevelt learning from them? And it's very difficult to tell. And I mean, we could introduce characters like Edward Bernays into this and you know, really see how public opinion was being managed at the time. But yeah. Roosevelt seems more like a character that was being created in the moment with a very efficient, you know, Rudy Giuliani 9/11 style PR machine, just to, you know, attach a more modern reference or just to create a picture for people. While Lincoln's history, Lincoln was subject to a lot more criticism of the things he was doing at the time. He didn't have that that effective PR working for him. It's an interesting difference. But you know, when we stand in 2010 and look backwards at both of them, the result is very similar as far as what was produced. Whether you can use propaganda to write the history as you wish, then you know, the 1984 model, or do you need to reinvent the history and create a folklore for somebody later? Why the motivations why people would be motivated to do that? I think that's something that we could discuss at another time in great detail. But it's even interesting, you know, as you're telling the story about the fleet moving away from Pearl Harbor, and you know, the United States pursuing Japan to choke them off before they could destroy China. I mean, that was a legitimate concern for people at the time, but it was fed to them. You know, so it wasn't like people were saying, well, why are they doing this? I mean, they were very aware that they were pursuing the Japanese to choke them off in the Sino-Japanese conflict. So all of this is it's just amazing. It's almost like too much to get your head around the energy that went into inventing Roosevelt right then in the moment as
yes.
a man who could save the world.
Oh, you say it beautifully. And, you know, it wasn't just Roosevelt who pushed himself. He had a lot of people pushing him. And it's really interesting to be able to talk about it because it's like a breath of fresh air. It's like getting a nice drink of cold water after being out, you know, running for a while or something. Because for so long we've been running on this ideology, this imagery that they've given to us from the time when I was in high school on through, that, you know, we can finally start breaking through and getting some glimpses of, oh, well, now hold on a second. Let me soak up this bit of information here. For example, you know, we know about Roosevelt's cord packing scene. Now, how is it possible that anybody who wants to deal with his neighbor honestly can say, oh, yes, it's perfectly fine for FDR in order to have the ends, the means are completely justified. Sure, he should definitely threaten the Supreme Court and definitely try to get people onto the Supreme Court who are ideologically with him, because, of course, we want to make sure that the Constitution is broken. So the more people who think that what he wants to do with Social Security and all these other types of things, the more people who believe in that, who can be put on the court, the better. Well, yeah, the Constitution doesn't allow for this, but we'll just interpret it. We'll go with case law and precedent and things like that, rather than actually reading the words of the Constitution. So I think it's a great opportunity for people to say, yeah, maybe this man wasn't as good as I thought he was. Maybe some of the things that happened in the United States not only were economically bad policy and tricky as far as international policy goes, but also just plain dishonest from the standpoint of a guy who's supposed to be in the office of the presidency. And as great as they possibly think the ends were, do they possibly think they're justified? And we know that the ends weren't good. I mean, the things that Roosevelt did created a system of Social Security. People say Social Security was an insurance program. And, you know, I've heard from some conservatives who don't know better sometimes on the radio, they'll say, well, you know, in Roosevelt's time, he would never have imagined that Social Security would become the giant Ponzi scheme that it is now. It's like, are you kidding me? They paid out the first year. There was no way that people putting into Social Security could get out anything the first year because they hadn't put enough in, but it started paying. So clearly it was a Ponzi scheme from the start. You know, it wasn't, and you know, they say that Roosevelt thought it was an insurance plan. Well, no, Roosevelt didn't think it was an insurance plan at all. He portrayed it as an insurance plan, but that's not what it was. Everybody knew that. You know, it's just absolutely ridiculous. And I think you're right. There were many more people who were quite interested in promoting socialism, progressivism, from the time of Teddy Roosevelt through Woodrow Wilson, through Herbert Hoover. They were all in academia. They were very, very strong by the time Roosevelt got in. And if you look at what Roosevelt did, he had a lot of cover in the media. So, of course. And I think, I don't know how you feel about it, but I think there is a tendency also when you have national media covering people, there's a tendency for the reporters to have it very easy by just going to the national media outlets and getting the information. There's a tendency for the people to look towards the central authority.
Yes.
As the authority. It's a very easy thing for them to do, rather than investigating, finding alternate views. You think that's true?
Absolutely. I think that's completely true. I think that, yeah, people are well trained to respect and trust authoritative sources of information. You know, and maybe when you're young, you get something like, I don't know, 12 years of training where that person stands in front of the room in different situations. They know something, you don't. And if you sit there quietly, they'll tell you about it. When that room is gone and that person that's standing in front of the blackboard is no longer there, it's the politicians, it's their media. Yeah, I think that's a very natural transgression from one to the other. That's what happens.
And also substantively on the economic side, I would be very interested if people do think that the ends justified the means on the economic side for Roosevelt, that this man who had people working for him and who himself really loved Stalin and thought that Mussolini was right on the ball. And, of course, Mussolini's ideas have been carried through with the McCain campaign. The Country First campaign was actually something that was developed by Mussolini and the people in the Republican Party clearly knew that, so that ought to send some signals to people. But if we want to talk about the economics of it, and then we can talk a little bit about the final outcome of some of the military things of Roosevelt, what astonishes me is that people are unwilling to really debate, just honestly debate, whether or not these unconstitutional policies of Roosevelt's were any good. I mean, they come up with all sorts of spurious arguments like, well, you know, Social Security has brought people some great insurance, not realizing that it's in the red. It's not insured at all. The whole thing is bogus. Talking about how the Works Progress Administration kept people employed when in fact all it did was take money that could have been used for productive purposes to employ people for real things. And of course, Roosevelt doing things like seizing private gold, shutting down banks, imposing new regulations on banks, all these types of things. People like Robert Higgs point out the economic side is clearly against Roosevelt, but people don't pay attention to it.
Yeah, we have another little myth too there that the president that preceded Roosevelt was Herbert Hoover. The story that we will get in school is that Hoover did nothing, and then Roosevelt came in and did everything and fixed everything.
Yes.
And the truth is that Hoover tried the things that Roosevelt tried. Obviously, they failed. Roosevelt didn't say, let's try something else. He said, let's try those things harder. Simply put, longer. Let's with more ignorance of how horribly they are failing, and what the long-term consequences of these actions will be. So that it's amazing how these myths, this is just invented and sold. And, you know, really too, like one thing that I want to point out before we go any further is thinking about this. Well, we're thinking about the psychology of these people, like Roosevelt, Wilson, Lincoln. I know that the way we talk about them might lead some people to be kind of suspicious about what we're saying. And I think it's important just to drill down a little bit and look at the psychology. These people were not necessarily like James Bond villains, like all evil for no reason. I don't think any of them got up and walked by the mirror in the morning and stopped and said, you know, I am just the most evil, ghastly person in the world, and I'm going to make everybody think I'm great. And then they do this, you know, evil laugh and start their day. I really think that intellectuals, central planners, elitists, and the people who can control the levels of political power can do these rationalizations. They can do this self-talk. You mentioned the term the common good. I've talked about it before.
Oh, yeah.
That you know, omelets are made by breaking a few eggs. You know, if we can just pretend, and as far as we, I mean these people, can just pretend that human lives have the same value as eggs, and as, you know, Harry Brown pointed out one time, as long as they can ignore the fact that omelet never seems to be ready. You know, the omelet never seems to get made. But I really believe that these people have the ability to, or the, you know, this cognitive dissonance, this denial, this ability to do these rationalizations that what they're doing will have some kind of positive outcome, that it's for the common good. And I also think that to want to hold that kind of political power, there's a certain degree of narcissism that is necessary, where they say, I am smart enough or special enough or I am important enough that I am the man for this job. I can accomplish this task. And I think that really creates a perfect storm of these centrally planned unintended consequences and horror shows that result from people who might have been able to convince themselves, even when they're clearly, you know, serving the needs of bankers, of Wall Street, of special interests, of unions. They're saying, no. Looks bad, feels bad, sounds bad, smells bad, but in the end, it's just going to be good.
Brett, I got to tell you, I wish we were hanging around. This is just so much fun. I wish we were hanging around the coffee table, having hot chocolate and throwing darts, and and we would record this or other things too, and then just like hand them out to people, like, hey, come on over to the party. This is great stuff to be able to discuss, and as I said, this is the kind of stuff I would only get when I would go down to Fee or I was at maybe an IHS seminar or something like that. And you clearly have looked at this very, very closely, precisely, with an understanding of the ethics of it, the propaganda of it, the social side of it, the economics of it, politics, and what you brought up, that ends justifying the means thing. I think a great way to look at Roosevelt is the way that he ended, the way that he started to push towards the end of the war in the European theater in World War II. When here he is, you've got Patton, one of the greatest strategists in the history of man, as far as warfare goes. And, you know, I don't want to, you know, promote warfare as being wonderful or anything like that. But you got Patton. He wants to get in and get it done and get his guys home, you know? And my uncle was with Patton's staff. And, you know, they're going up through Europe. They're going through mountains and all these things. My uncle was shot twice and run over by a tank, and he survived. Luckily, it was muddy ground, so it just squished him into the ground. He got 2 Purple Hearts and a Silver Star in World War II, in this war that Roosevelt helped to, you know, set up, I believe. But anyway, regardless of that, if you look at the way the war concluded, there's a perfect example of the ends justifying the means. He's got one of the greatest military commanders ready to go into Berlin, ready to take over Germany. And he actually not only tells him to hold back, but withholds his gasoline, doesn't give him the supplies necessary to function properly in a foreign theater. He commands that Patton not go in. And when Patton says, screw you, I'm going, because we're going to take this city before the Soviets take it. He knew what was going to happen to Berlin. He knew. He knew what was going to happen to Germany. And, of course, Roosevelt doesn't want to upset Stalin. I don't know why. Stalin's killing hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. And, of course, all throughout Soviet history, you know, multiple, at least 3 times, maybe 6 times more people died through different Soviet leaders' actions and the KGB and so on, and the Cheka, then died in Nazi Germany. I'm not saying that this is a matter of equivalence or one's worse than the other or anything like that. But as far as the actions of a president to do this to one of his best commanders, and his commander is telling him, look, these guys are bad guys. There are free people who are going to be imprisoned. There are people who are going to die here. Get us in. Let us go. That tells you something, I think. It tells you that Roosevelt put political ends above the real importance of human lives and freedom. And that's pretty disgusting.
I agree. I absolutely agree. And I think there is a real natural evil that is required to want to get into a position of that kind of power. I think that, you know, the rationalizations are fighting that realization in these people. But I think a lot of times, you know, when we're looking at the people who are in these positions, they are sociopaths. They are authoritarian sociopaths. And they, only regard other, this common good or this greater good or this national interest is essentially an abstraction that allows them to continue to completely disregard the idea that other human beings and other people's lives are as valuable as their own.
Yeah, that brings it right back to the school thing we began with. You know, I mean, it's a perfect circle. And which is, you know, one of the reasons why it's so great that people can listen to what you have to say. And, you know, I hope I haven't gone on too long on some of these things. One of the things that I know when you get in a conversation sometimes, Brett, is, you know, you have a lot of information built up and you want to express yourself. And so sometimes I like to pull back a little bit and, you know, sort of just say, okay, shut up, you know, cause you gotta put the info out and then just pull back, you know?
It's good. Like one of the reasons why I really don't have any time limitations for any of this, but I tend to skip stones across the surface of deeper concepts sometimes because, you know, I was trained really to talk about history. I really trained myself to talk about history to people who weren't interested in it in a way that was presentable, in a way that was engaging. And sometimes it meant, you know, skipping over details or exploring topics in a little bit more depth. So with this series, while some of the shows will be sort of quick surveys across a large idea, these are people that we've talked about today that I really wanted to drill down a little bit. So I'm really glad that we were able to do that with both of them. And I think that sometimes it's easy to talk in overviews, but when you can really present some solid facts about what these people were doing, what the results were, and even making some educated guesses about what their intentions were, I think is very valuable. So of course, I set no limits on any of these shows. If they run really long, I split them into two parts. And I think that it's a good your knowledge is a good complement to the way that I usually treat these stories, where sometimes I'll go through something and I'll say, oh, you know, I might have gone just a little bit too fast. You know what I mean? Oh.
Yeah, yeah, right. I understand it. Yep, yep. Well, this is great. And, you know, it's really – I mean, I look at some of the guys that I read, you know, DiLorenzo and Amity Schles is awesome. And, you know, Jim Powell's stuff. And, as we mentioned, the book Emancipating Slaves and Enslaving Free Men. You know, you think about some of these people and they go into such great detail that obviously we're only scratching the surface. And I hope people will check out some of these books by people like Jeffrey Rogers Hummel and people like Tom DiLorenzo and people like Amity Schles. And, you know, Amity Schles is more of a Friedmanite. She's not completely opposed to central banking and so on, but, you know, we have that slight disagreement, but she's clearly a libertarian. She, you know, is a great researcher, and she has written a remarkable book about some of the amazing things that happened during Roosevelt's administration that, for some peculiar reason, as you say, you know, Roosevelt got away with this stuff, and he continued to get away with it and continues to this day in the pop media to get away with this and is lionized as a saint.
Yeah.
You know, these people were people. They had their hands on a machine called government that at its outset cannot be used for good, because its only way of existing is by taking from people. So from that initial taking of tax money in order to create the very government entity that's supposed to protect you from other people, essentially you've got the initial sin right there. You know, you've got original sin in government right there, and it cannot operate in any other way but to attract people who will try to take advantage of it, because people know, you know, they know that people are going to be forced to have to pay no matter what. So a guy like Roosevelt, hey, you know, they say he fooled around on his wife. Now they come up with all sorts of arguments and excuses to say, well, you know, she was probably not interested in men anyway. So he found a way to relieve his stress and so on and so forth. It's like, you know, sorry, but it's dishonest. Oh, she probably know about it. Okay, well, whatever. How about this? How about the fact that the guy was dishonest in his oath to the Constitution? How about the fact that this man wanted to increase the size of government? How about the fact that supposedly this man wanted to make everybody secure with Social Security and called it an insurance program, and he knew it wasn't an insurance program? And supposedly he wanted to make sure that people were helped as quickly as possible. But just like we see with Barack Obama, the money is going to politically connected people, and it's not being used to help people. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And of course, we know that it can't help people because it only can pull money from the productive economy, which harms everyone in the long run.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that leads into the last question, which is already partially answered, which is, first of all, I picked these two characters, Lincoln and Roosevelt, because I think that they are perhaps the two best examples of people who overstepped their bounds, overstepped the limitations that were placed on them, the sort of trust that people put in them, and how they perhaps not so coincidentally are also made into the two biggest heroes of government school history classes, which says a lot about the message. And these are the two people who not only had no respect for the limitations that were placed on their political power, but through that, and really hand in hand with that, show no respect for the individual rights of their fellow human beings. And those are your heroes in government schools. So the last question that I would ask you is, what is the consequence? What is the result of history being taught this way, of these kinds of people being made into heroes and being lionized like they are?
Well, clearly, the risk is that in the future, people will be much more susceptible to, A, accepting other iconic figures and not looking at their backgrounds, not looking critically at what they propose. And that leads into B, actually, because of the icon worship of the person as an image. and the eradication, the erasure of the information that would portray these people in any sort of a negative light, whether it be constitutional information, historical, economic, it's all historical, of course, in the long run, but whatever the particular substrata might be, it leaves people very susceptible to the thinking that this sort of approach is beneficial. And of course, that leads to a greater destruction of individual liberty and freedom. I think you can probably make a pretty clear syllogism, Brett, to say that the more people worship the iconic figure, the less they can hold on to their own individual freedoms.
Yeah.
I think that's very clear. And so I think it's also very clear that not only is it just a matter of honesty that gets me upset, but it's a matter of future risk that more people will become prone to this sort of ideology to say, oh yes, this is definitely the way to go. This guy was a good guy. And, you know, the history is forgotten. Very, very dangerous.
Absolutely. Well put. And, in closing today, I just, I mentioned your show. I mentioned your book. If people want to learn more about what you're doing, what should they do?
Hey, head over to LibertyConspiracy.com and hop into our forums if they are so inclined. We definitely love their conversation. We love the input. We've got some great posts in the forum about some pretty interesting subjects, ranging from foreign policy and the so-called war on terror, and to intellectual property, and some pretty abstract ideas on intellectual property, to music and things like that. And we would definitely suggest that if people are also interested, we have a phone hotline. And if they listen to our pods, they can listen to that. They can also subscribe to our pods at the Liberty Conspiracy website. There's a little link there. They can subscribe there. And they can pick up the book, Live Free or Die. It's over at Amazon.com. And the articles are arranged in such a way that it shows you my intellectual development from a small government constitutionalist Lockean into a total free market anarchist, maybe Rothbardian or Mises type person. So there you go. I think that pretty much sums it up, my man.
Excellent. Well, I greatly, greatly appreciate you joining me. And as we discussed prior to getting started tonight, this will probably be the first of a number of collaborations coming in the future. There's certainly no shortage of topics that we could speak on together, or even in a little group. So I definitely look forward to doing that. And again, I thank you so much for joining me.
I look forward to it. Thank you. Big time. Thank you so much, Brett.
Both Liberty Conspiracy and School Sucks Podcast are helped along considerably by the continuous support of Jason Osborne. Also worth mentioning that hopefully this is the last time that you will hear my voice without a new website to direct people to, schoolsucksproject.com. And hopefully there will be something new to show all of you within the next week, with a lot of new features and a lot of new things to check out. And hopefully I will be announcing that in the very next episode of the show. In the introduction to this series, I used a song called River of Deceit, which is very clearly about addiction. Now, I'm not the first person to make a comparison between statism, the expansion of state power, or the embrace or increased reliance on state power, and addiction. But I hope these last two episodes, these periods that we've discussed, the presidency of Abraham Lincoln and the presidency of Franklin Roosevelt, illustrate two experimental weekend coke binges, if you will, in the expansion of state power that helped lead us to the throes of addiction that we are currently dealing with in the 21st century. In the next episode, we will continue to look at the consequences of this addiction with a case study of one particular government program that is especially horrible. Until next time, thank you very much for listening, and take care. And I will leave you with a wrap up of the topic of Franklin Roosevelt, his policies, and their consequences. See ya.
I am prepared, under my constitutional duty, to recommend the measures that a stricken nation in the midst of a stricken world may require. But in the event that the national emergency is still critical, I shall not evade the clear course of duty that will then confront me. I shall ask the Congress for the one remaining instrument to meet the crisis: broad executive power.
It was the start of what would become known as the New Deal. Roosevelt assembled a group of young technocrats and planners in Washington. He told them that their job was to plan and run giant new industrial projects for the good of the nation. Roosevelt was convinced that the stock market crash had shown that laissez-faire capitalism could no longer run modern industrial economies. It had become the job of government. Big business was horrified. But the New Deal attracted the admiration of the Nazis, especially Joseph Goebbels.
Wir betrachten die wirtschaftliche Entwicklung in Amerika mit dem allergrößten positiven Interesse. Und wir sind dort der festen Überzeugung, dass Präsident Roosevelt und seine Berater auf dem richtigen Wege sind.
This is when they're going to fight with everything they've got. This is when they'll spread all kinds of wild rumors designed to scare and intimidate people. That's why I need your help. There have been some of the pundits in Washington who have been saying, well, maybe you've been trying to do too much. Maybe you've been pushing too far, too fast. And I try to remind them, I said, listen, I never said change would be easy. Change is hard. It's always been hard. When FDR introduced Social Security, you know what happened? They called it socialism. But senior citizens decided that, you know what? If I've got some protection in my golden years, that's something that's worth fighting for. When Medicare...
What I mean for example is that if you look at America's Social Security system, using the Madoff example, you could say that America's Social Security system is a Ponzi scheme, which in fact it is. The retirees who draw benefits are being funded by the workers who are paying into the system now. There is no fund in the American so-called Social Security fund. It's just a Ponzi scheme. It's new people paying in, paying off retirees. As the economy unravels and as this global crisis becomes more profound, the American Social Security system will, in fact, take the biscuit as the world's biggest Ponzi scheme. It's a $50 trillion Ponzi scheme. I think when you add up all the liabilities, ultimately, and you can make the same case for.
But
other
isn't the point about the, that? Isn't that a point about that that there's a astronomical amount of time and that the they can keep doing it because until the sun explodes, maybe.
Well, what's kept it going has been 25 years worth of growth, so-called. But what we're finding is that as the economy contracts and as jobs are lost and companies are unable to pay into these schemes anymore, the new money that it takes to sustain a Ponzi scheme or a pyramid scheme disappears. This is why the Bernie Madoff Ponzi scheme collapsed, is because the global credit crunch that started 18 months ago started to affect the client's ability to keep adding more funds, which is at the base of the pyramid. So similarly, in the Social Security case, as more and more people are unable to pay into the front door of the scam, the back door therefore can't pay off the retirees. So this is going to go the way of the Bernie Madoff empire of scam as well.
Driving that train, have cocaine, it's the J.
just crossed my mind.